Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown, and I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer, and today on The Breakdown, we're being joined by a woman who made history when she took over as president of the United Farm Workers in 2018, the first female to lead that storied labor union, and the first immigrant woman to lead a national union in U.S. history.
We are thrilled to have Teresa Romero joining us. She's a Mexican immigrant tasked with advocating for the people who put food on our tables but are often forgotten, and she actually started at UFW as an assistant to the president, so we'll find out how she ended up in charge of the whole thing and what she's focusing on at a time of great uncertainty for the labor movement. But first, Scott, more information trickling in about this burgeoning Senate race next year to replace Dianne Feinstein. You reported just this morning on a new poll out. What do we know?
Yeah, so this is a poll by Berkeley IGS, Mark DiCamillo, a well-known pollster in the state of California. And we can't overemphasize, Marisa, this is a snapshot. You know, this is very early. And really what this is in some ways, it is an indication of name ID. How well known are these folks? And I should say also this poll was only of Democrats and no party preference voters, no Republicans. So just keep that in mind. And there were two versions of it, too. There was one with Ro Khanna, one without, because there's been talk of him getting in. But bottom line, in both of those, both versions, Adam Schiff is first. Without Khanna, he's at 23%, followed by Katie Porter at 20%. And then Barbara Lee is a distant third with 8%. And when you add Khanna into the mix, it's pretty much the same. Lee drops about a couple percentage points to 6. Khanna's at 4. But the big news, 39% in this poll are undecided. So there's a lot of room for all these candidates to grow because their voter image is pretty good.
Yeah, not a ton of surprise there. I mean, we've been talking about this a little bit here internally, Scott. I think sometimes those of us in the mix of politics estimate how well known folks are because, you know, they're not doing the jobs we do every day and talking to these people and listening to them. But I do think that this is good news for both Schiff and Porter, right? It does show that there is familiarity, that they don't seem to have a lot of unhappy Democrats. But, you know, we've been talking about this for several weeks. I mean, this could be, all told, what, $100 million race? I mean, this is going to be expensive no matter what, but especially given those undecided numbers, you'd think that that's really where the money is going to need to go, is just introducing themselves.
Right. And this primary is going to be most likely in March, unless for some reason it gets separated out, the primary from the presidential primary. But let's assume it's in March. If, you know, a Republican jumps in, and we don't know that there will be one, that's going to be probably the ball game, quite honestly, because the Republican will probably be in the top two against whichever Democrat comes in first. I guess the question is, are we going to have two Democrats running off in November or a Democrat and a Republican? We don't know that. But clearly, it's a really uphill climb for any Republican to win statewide. That hasn't happened since 2006, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who some people said would he jump in, but we don't think so. We don't think so. All right. Well, let's turn to another kind of big issue in California. This is the price of gas and oil, not just an issue here, an issue internationally. We saw finally, months after the governor called on lawmakers to do something about the spikes in gas prices that we all lived through last year. First hearing, 4 hours in the state capitol. This was an informational hearing, so nothing decided. But it was really an opportunity for his administration to kind of lay out their still semi-undefined proposal to basically assess a penalty on oil companies if their profits hit sort of a certain point, which is undefined. But also, to me, the most interesting part is they really talked a lot about the kind of transparency that the bill by Nancy Skinner out of Oakland, based on what the governor called for. Essentially, what a lot of experts spent the 4 hours saying is we just don't know why oil prices are what they are, and we might understand more or be able to keep them down if we had more information.
Well, and that's a very good point. At the same time, if you don't know why they're so high, how can you do something to bring them down if you're not really sure what is in the first place making them high? I think certainly more information would be helpful, for sure. You know, I was struck by, you know, Gavin Newsom has been saying all along that it's greed. Greed is the explanation that gas prices are $2 or more per gallon in California than they are in other states. But, you know, it's also a market-based economy. We have a different kind of gas, a cleaner gas here in California that can account for some of the higher price, but certainly not all of it. And it did seem that there were a lot of questions, even among the Democrats, as to whether or not this could really work and really help consumers.
Yeah, and I think that is an open question. I mean, again, without details of what exactly the mechanism is for deciding what is, you know, an unfair profit, right? And then when do we assess what, of course, the administration is calling a penalty, what opponents are calling a tax? But I do think that for me, as sort of a layperson who, quite frankly, is not deeply involved in energy markets or understands the kind of all of this, it was just interesting to hear, you know, some of the sort of smartest people in state government who do this type of data analysis on all kinds of other, you know, sort of industries for a living, just say there are so many questions we don't have answers to. The oil companies say we can't give you that information because of antitrust concerns. I kind of just wonder if that's where things end up. If this penalty maybe, you know, doesn't go very far, but if the state could get more information, could legislate the requirement for more information, that in itself would be a huge win, because what we heard this week was that for 40 years, lawmakers and policymakers have been talking about getting more information and they've never succeeded. So I'll be watching that, but, you know, it was a slow start for something we've all waited months to start.
And not really any more details about what the final bill might look like. But there's time. There's time. Yeah.
All right. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be joined by United Farm Workers Union President Teresa Romero. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, here with Scott Schaefer. We are thrilled to welcome Teresa Romero. She's president of the United Farm Workers Union, also known as UFW. Teresa, welcome to The Breakdown.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're very excited to have you. And, you know, we like to start at the beginning. So we would love to hear about the beginning of your life. You were born in Mexico City, but I think you grew up in Guadalajara, one of six kids. What was your childhood like?
You know, I had a very normal, regular childhood. My mom was a stay-home mom. My dad worked. He worked for many years in the same company where he started as a low-level mechanic, and he worked for a tortilla machine company. And he, you know, over the years, he also became the manager or one of their biggest offices. And that's why we had to move to Guadalajara. Yeah. It was a very normal life, you know, with mom at home and dad working.
Two big cities, Guadalajara and Mexico City.
Yes.
I'm wondering about your grandmother, because I know that I believe she was Zapotec and very, you know, close to you. Tell us about your grandma and what influence she had on you and the family.
You know, she was. And years later, I learned more about the Zapotecan culture, but she was a very strong woman. She was a woman who, as we were growing up, she would say, you can do it all. You whatever you can put your mind to it, you can do it all. And you know, I grew up understanding that, yeah, I'm a girl, and I'm a girl, especially in Mexico, where, you know, many of the women stay home and stay with the family. But my grandmother was one who supported us through everything. She was a woman who barely, you know, when she got married, didn't even speak Spanish. All she spoke was Zapotecan. So to the end of her life, her Spanish was also very limited.
That's incredible. I read that you've talked about education being very important to your family. How did that manifest? Was there ever pressure as a woman to not sort of focus on that part of your life?
You know, my mom, because of course, probably also heard it from her mother, my grandmother, wanted all of her kids to go to school, to get a whatever education we wanted. And we didn't get the pressure of specific things that she wanted us to do. She just said, what do you want? What do you want to do when you grow up? What is important to you? And we all got an education, but I believe my grandmother's influence to this day is a big part of my life.
Hmm. How did you end up coming to California?
I was hoping to come here, like, you know, I had just finished college. I wanted to come and I wanted to travel and I wanted to explore and then, you know, take a year and go back and work in Mexico. But as I was here, you know, my family wanted to also come. They wanted to explore. They wanted to be here. So it changed my perspective. You know, I started working.
How old were you when you came here?
24.
Okay.
And they, you know, little by little, they started coming. Until all of them were here, and even my parents came. And to this day, all of us are U.S. citizens.
Huh. So when you came, I mean, had you gone to college in Mexico? Were you just working?
Like, I just had finished college in Mexico. I finished college in Mexico, and I stayed for a few months trying to figure out what I was going to do. I had a part-time job. And then I decided to come against my father's will because he was so concerned. What are you going to do there all by yourself? You don't speak the language. But, you know, I had that grandma in me and I needed to try it.
Yeah. How did you find California, you know, as a place to be, you know, without, you know, having to learn the language, coming from a different country, a different culture? What was that transition like?
It is difficult. I thought I had some knowledge of English because I studied in high school and I studied in college. But when I got here and I tried to have a conversation, it was very difficult. I realized that I did not know the English that I needed. And, you know, being by yourself, not speaking the language, not having family, culture is different. I remember going to the first Mexican restaurant and I ordered a tostada and they brought me some elaborate thing. And I said, no, I ordered a tostada. And they said, yeah, this is a tostada.
It's a California tostada.
Everything's bigger
California
here.
Tostada. So it took a while to adjust. My way of learning English, I remember I would not watch TV in Spanish. Everything was in English. The radio was in English. And I would learn 5 to 10 sentences every day that I would repeat loudly. So I'm in the store, I'm going somewhere and I'm talking to myself and people were looking at me saying, what's wrong with this woman? But that helped me a lot. That's how I really learned how to speak English.
I can empathize with this as somebody who learned Spanish in a classroom and then realized how little I knew when I went to Spanish-speaking countries, including Mexico. Yes. So you're here, you're learning the language, you end up in construction management consulting. What did that look like? How did that happen?
No, but that was afterwards. I first started working with, and for many years, at a law firm that helped people with immigration issues, that helped people with workers' compensation issues. I remember at that time, we would help farm workers on their immigration issues. Never to, you know, even in my wildest dreams, I thought that I was going to end up, you know, with the UFW. The construction company became later.
Was this like clerical work you were doing?
With the law firm?
Yeah.
I was the manager of the law firm. Okay. I would manage all the cases, the attorneys, the people, the staff. So I managed the entire thing. Wow. But the attorneys, of course, handled the cases. And after that, I started working. I created a consulting firm that managed construction projects for school districts. In 2008, when the recession hit, construction is one of the things that unfortunately gets affected first. Hmm. And I started looking for work and I ended up here.
Yeah. So you started off, you were working as an assistant to the president, but it was supposed to be temporary. How did you end up where you are now?
You know, it was in my mind, I thought I can do this 2-3 years and then I go back to my business. But, you know, working with Arturo, I was very hands-on and I immediately started going to meetings with workers, hearing the workers' challenges, hearing the workers' issues, hearing how difficult the work is. And after probably 6 months of interacting with workers, I thought to myself, I'm not going anywhere. This is where I need to be.
Did you feel like the feeling was mutual? Because as we've kind of laid out, you weren't a farm worker prior to this. And I wonder if there was ever pushback on that.
You know, it wasn't. I'm an immigrant. I know what people go through. I know the fears that they have. I've heard from them how they wanted to see their families that they haven't seen in 10, 15, 20 years. And that really hit me. I still cry when I have these conversations. But that really hit me because I understood that even though I went through some challenges, nothing compared to farm workers. And I was blessed to be received by farm workers as one of them, even though I have never worked in the fields. Mm.
You mentioned that when you grew up in Mexico, you know, women sort of had their place and it wasn't necessarily at the top of the corporation or the union. What kind of sexism or, you know, any anti-female attitude or harassment did you notice working your way up in the union?
Oh, my God, no. You know, Arturo is he was my mentor. He was and he is a very, you know, he dedicated his life to farm workers. And he knew that what we were doing was for farm workers. So his focus, the board, my coworkers, everything was, what can we do together to improve the lives of farm workers? I did not, like I said, at first my focus was going to be a short term, but I never experienced that within the union. When we say that we want farm workers to be treated with respect and dignity, we start at home. We do that within the union.
And you're talking, of course, about Arturo Rodriguez, who was the former UFW president. You are only the third, we should say. Cesar Chavez was the first. I wonder, though, to Scott's point, I mean, you are, and we're going to get to the politics in this in a minute, but a lot of your job is outward facing, too, right? It's interfacing with farm workers, but it's also interfacing with state lawmakers, policymakers, the governor. Do you think you bring anything different to the role because you're a woman when it comes to that kind of outward facing stuff?
You know, I do. When I talk to farm workers and I talk to women and they hear my story and they hear that I came, you know, like them without knowing the language, without knowing anybody, they feel inspired. They feel that they have more within them to give and they feel encouraged. I have been, you know, dealing with at the federal level and the state level with elected officials who understand the history of the UFW, the work that we do, and that as a union, we do not just focus on representing workers through a union contract, but we do things that would impact the lives of farm workers, whether they have a union or not. And having that history, having that respect for the union, it translates to me as a person. But this comes from 60 years of history.
Farm workers were unexpectedly and tragically at the focus of the shootings in Half Moon Bay a few weeks ago. And governor went down there, was shocked at the housing conditions and so on. What did you make of that, his reaction to that? Because I would think that there's deplorable housing for farm workers all over the state and shouldn't really be that surprising given how little political power they have.
You know, and that is key. People assume that they know. And that's why when we do this work, when we marched last year, when we met with the governor, when we meet with elected officials in D.C., I'm not the only face. We bring farm workers. I can be a voice for farm workers, but nobody can explain their challenges better than themselves. So many, many, I don't know if you know, but last year we invited all 100 senators to work in the fields.
How'd
because
that go?
We want them to go. Two of them did
none
it.
None of them left their jobs, huh?
Alex, pardon me?
None of them left their Senate jobs to do full-time work?
No. One of them was Alex Padilla. He came to California, and the other one was Cory Booker. Alex Padilla is walking next to a worker that is fast as you can ever imagine. And he starts a conversation with him and said, how long have you been doing this? And the worker said, 50 years. He says, 50 years? How old are you? He said, 70. And the senator said, why don't you retire? And he says, because if I retired, even though I pay taxes, I don't get Social Security. So if I don't work, I can't pay my rent. And this is the reality that we see. And we see it firsthand. And the Half Moon Bay workers, it is just an example of what we know and we hear from workers throughout the country. And unfortunately, you know, this is something that brings attention. And in many cases, after a week or two, 7 people die. But after a week or two, people don't talk about it anymore.
Yeah. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED. I am Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. We're talking to UFW President Teresa Romero. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. Teresa, I wonder, you know, UFW obviously it got its start in California. Delano, we were discussing this before we came on air, the birthplace of the movement in the Central Valley. But these days, yes, the union does not represent a lot of workers. A lot of what your work seems to be is advocacy. Can you just talk about that? And then, like, how do you view this job? What is the main role of UFW in 2023?
You know, you probably know that farm workers were excluded from any labor rights in the 1930s. And these was there were racist reasons, nothing more. Unfortunately, we have a workforce that is largely undocumented. And when farm workers organize, when farm workers come to us with issues, and when they know that we're going to organize, they're afraid. They get fired. They have family members in the same farm and everybody gets fired. There have been cases where workers have been deported for organizing. So when that so much is at stake that your life is going to change, as it is, you have work that is seasonal. If you lose your job, you don't have a way to support your family. The reason we marched last year, over 335 miles in the middle of summer was because we wanted Governor Newsom to sign our legislation, a legislation that would make it safer for farm workers to vote for union representation. That's what they need. When Cesar started the union, he understood that they needed more than a union. At that time, he started with clinics. You know, we had clinics in different places that would help farm workers. And we continue to do that. We have created different programs. We do legislative work. We do political work. And this bill in California is going to help us organize workers in a way that is safe. And when you think about it, like, for example, farm workers are not entitled to overtime pay, workers' comp protections in other states. In order to get this, we have to do it state by state because they were excluded from the NLRB. So it's there are many challenges that we face and many challenges farm workers face. But when their livelihood is at risk, they prefer to deal with abuses, with not getting paid, with bad housing, then speak up.
There was a study done by researchers at UC Merced recently that said there are essentially no unionized California farm workers. The number of active members is so low that it actually just falls within the margin of error. And critics of UFW say, well, the union hasn't put its shoulder to the wheel and done the hard work of organizing. What's your response to that?
That is not true. We have been here for 60 years. We have been organizing workers. We have seen the challenges. Just put yourself, try to put yourself in their shoes, that they know that they're going to, that the chances of getting deported, getting fired, the family members of the same company getting fired is something that they don't want to risk. They have children. You know, we had the pandemic. During the pandemic, we all, you and I, Scott, are working from home today. And they don't have that opportunity to work from home. They had to continue working. What did we do? We went and got donations of masks so we can distribute throughout Washington, Oregon, and California. So it is, farm workers were not even, they didn't feel comfortable asking for protective equipment. They were working with whatever they had. So there's other things that we're doing to, our goal is to impact the lives of farm workers. We believe that collective bargaining is the best way to do it. But there are other ways, as we try to do heat illness protection so workers don't die because of high temperatures.
Yeah.
So those are the things that we're trying to do to impact a large number of workers.
You've also talked a lot about immigration reform as being one of the top priorities of UFW. And I'm wondering if that is in part because, I mean, obviously there's a lot of good reasons for it from your perspective, but it would probably make it easier to organize and get farm workers' rights if a lot of them weren't as worried about being deported.
Of course. Immigration is something that we have been working on for many years. We came very close last year, but unfortunately, there were very some organizations, girls organizations that wanted more. We compromise. We know how important immigration is for our members, and we don't assume. We sit down with workers, members and non-members, and ask them what they want. We tell them what it is that they want and what they're willing to compromise. We're guided by the workers. And unfortunately, although we passed this bill in the House twice, in 2019 and 2020, we could not get 60 senators to support it. 10 of them needed to be Republicans. We couldn't get them.
Yeah. Well, the work that you do is, and the work that your people you represent do is so serious and hard. And I'm wondering, what do you do for fun? Like, what do you do to just let loose and, you know, kind of let go
relax,
of all the stress?
You know, like I said, I worked with Arturo and I learned from him that we give many hours to the work that we do. I love reading. I love traveling. I haven't had much of the time of traveling, but I have now a one-year-old granddaughter. So that is where I try to spend most of my free time with that little girl, because it's right now it's she's my new toy.
So do you still have family in Mexico?
I have aunts, uncles, cousins, yes. You know, my parents, family siblings have passed away except for one brother, my father's brother, who just turned 93 years old and went to Mexico during December to celebrate his 93rd birthday and was able to see a lot of my family members that I hadn't seen in a long time.
But your abuela in California.
I am, and I'm loving it.
Thank you. UFW
Thank you so
President
much.
Teresa Romero, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's going to do
it.
Thank
you very much.
Yeah, thank you. That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We are a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our engineer is Christopher Beal, and our producer is Guy Marzorati. I'm Scott Schaefer. Find more of KQED's politics coverage by subscribing to our Political Breakdown newsletter. You'll find it at kqed.org/newsletters.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. We'll see you next week.